We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Hi, this is Brant Houston from the College of Media, sitting in for David Inge today, with our guest Frank Contreras, who is an Al Jazeera reporter in Mexico and reporting around Latin America. He has extensive experience, and he actually began his career in Iowa, I believe. Is that right? Right, Frank?
That's right, yes, at WSUI in Iowa City.
Yes. And we're going to be talking today about his journalism and reporting basically in a war zone called Mexico. And if you have any questions, please call 333-9455 or from outside the area, 800-222-9455. So, Frank, tell us what it is like to report in Mexico at this moment.
Well, Mexico, as you know, Brant, has become one of the most deadly countries in the entire world for professional journalists. It's a place where more journalists are killed or kidnapped than even places like Iraq or Afghanistan at this moment. So it's become quite a tricky place to do this sort of work. In a normal theater of war, you have a very clear set of counterparts, you know, the government fighting a certain group or two opposing governments fighting each other. It's generally very clear who the sides are and where you ought to be so that you don't get caught up in the crossfire. In Mexico, that's quite different because we have more than seven drug trafficking cartels, many of which are more heavily armed than the government itself, Brant. They have now 50 caliber machine guns. They have bazookas that they're using, and we've seen instances where they actually take down aircraft. Lots of this is not being reported. Helicopters downed by these kinds of drug trafficking organizations that are, as I say, heavily armed. The Mexican government is at its limits just about now, pushing itself to continue to fight this fight. It's a fight that President Felipe Calderón initiated upon entering his presidency in 2006. In general, I live in the Mexican capital, Mexico City, and in general, I would say it's fairly calm. It's a fairly quiet, if you can imagine, a city of 25 million people is quiet. But it's fairly peaceful in that sense that there is not that kind of open violence. The violence is specific. It's in specific parts of the country. And when you go to those places, that's when you've got to be very careful.
Well, they're very sophisticated, too, in tracking down journalists. I mean, I believe there have been 24 journalists killed in Mexico since 1992, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Recently, they got a journalist who was using social media. So they're pretty sophisticated in tracking down a journalist in person, online, or whatever. So.
The story that you're talking about is about a woman in the north, right?
Yeah, Nuevo Laredo, yes.
That's right. You know the story. Your listeners probably know the story. She was using social media basically to talk about the kind of drug trafficking crimes that were taking place in that border city, and then her body turned up dead, mutilated shortly thereafter. This is starting to happen increasingly common. It's an increasingly common problem in certain parts of the country. So there are ways that they can track people down. A couple of journalist colleagues were tracked down in the Mexican capital itself, where we had not seen these kinds of crimes. They were recently captured, found tortured and dead as well. So it can be quite a risk.
And so what kinds of precautions do you take when you're trying to do this reporting?
Journalists all over the world, when we're working in these conflict zones, we're taught how to use certain tactics, certain techniques. We're always told, make a plan before you go in. Make an escape plan, especially if you get pulled over by a black vehicle and heavily armed men come out. What is your plan? What are you going to do? Lots of times, all you can do is sit and wait and see what happens. Unfortunately, some colleagues have been kidnapped and taken away this way, and sometimes they never show up again. For foreign correspondents in the country, it's rare that we're the ones who are the targets, actually. It's mostly the Mexican journalists who are working in the cities outside the capital, in those specific regions where the drug violence is raging. Let me underscore that the entire country is not in this kind of conflict. There are very specific places where this is taking place. And so And so the journalists who are working there, especially those journalists who go so far as to connect names of perhaps corrupt police officials who are working with criminal organizations, those are the journalists who are really facing the trouble.
What about being an Al Jazeera journalist? Has that had any effect, positive, negative, in terms of that? Al Jazeera has come much more into the mainstream, hired many reporters, have extensive experience with other programs, other companies. How's it for you?
That's right. Well, I came to Al Jazeera from public radio in the United States. I was a correspondent for The World on Public Radio International and did that job for about a decade, 10 years, covering Mexico and Latin America. The transition to television was interesting. I never thought I'd be on television. For a long time, I didn't even have a television set. Mm-hmm. I was really a radio guy. Yeah. And so it's been quite interesting. Al Jazeera is really become an organization that's quite well recognized. And so now when the Mexican government hears that we're looking for an interview with some high-level functionary, they generally take us pretty seriously now. And I think that's largely because of the work my colleagues are doing covering what's happening in the Middle East right now. There's these historic changes taking place in so many countries in the Middle East, Libya, Tunisia, Syria, Yemen. So many different countries are going through this kind of upheaval and change. Egypt. And so as the network continues to cover that in a very serious way, with a lot of, for example, with a lot of veteran BBC correspondents,
right.
A lot of the people who you will see and hear on the air on Al Jazeera are British people or Americans like myself. And so I think that with time, this network is being taken very seriously.
Well, I want to once again tell people I'm speaking with Frank Contreras. This is Brand Houston from the College of Media. If you have a question, please call 333-9455 from outside the area. It would be 800-222-9455. I also want to mention that Frank will be on the University of Illinois campus today. And there's a public event that begins at 4 p.m. this afternoon in 100 Gregory Hall. That's on the UI campus, and the talk is titled Al Jazeera, Foreign Correspondent Reporting from Mexico. So what are the stories that we're missing, Frank, that are not getting the play in the United States? Al Jazeera obviously is broadcast in the U.S., but not as widely as some of the other networks. So what do you think we're not seeing? What are the stories? You said one thing. You said we don't hear about the heavy armament, the shooting down of helicopters. Other stories from Mexico?
Yes. Well, from Mexico, I think we need to tell more the story of why the country remains such a problematic place. It is a place that many U.S. investors love still. They find it, even with all this kind of the violence and with the government fighting these drug trafficking organizations, it's still a place where a good number of U.S. citizens are going for vacation. Mm-hmm. Some people say, really? Is that true?
Well, there are people still retiring there. Right?
That's right. In fact, I think the largest number of U.S. citizens who are retired and live outside of the country are living in Mexico. It's more than 1.5 million people at this stage. So it's still a place where a lot of U.S. citizens have a very personal contact, not just people of Mexican descent, but all kinds of folks from this part of the country as well like to go to Mexico. And so I think it would be really important for me to try to do more reporting on other issues, not just the drug war. There are many other things taking place. Mexico is about to get ready for presidential elections. We're less than a year away now from holding a new election. The voters will decide who will lead the country, and it looks like they're going to seriously consider going back to an old political party.
PRI, right?
Right. Yeah, they've governed the party, as you know, Brandt, for 71 consecutive years. And so there's interesting politics. There's a powerful economy that, despite the global economic crisis and the strong recession here in the United States, the economy in Mexico still continues to move along at a sluggish pace, certainly. But it's something that that I think that a lot of U.S. citizens should find very interesting. One of the stories that we do cover a lot in this drug war is the flow of firearms that head south. I'm from the state of Arizona, and it turns out that a good number of those firearms that are being used in Mexico's drug war are coming from the state of Arizona. So
there was a recent scandal involving the ATF and alcohol tobacco firearms.
That's right. That's right. There was a project that the federal government had actually to allow guns to flow into Mexico and then try to track those guns. Unfortunately, you can imagine, how do you track thousands of guns? And a lot of those slipped out of reach of the federal agents. And so many of those guns have been used in drug trafficking crimes. One of them, a 50 caliber machine gun, was used to down a helicopter in the western state of Sinaloa. So these are the kinds of things that in general I'm not seeing or hearing in other broadcast media.
Okay. Let's just check. Do we have any calls there? Okay. Let's take a call. Okay. Two calls. Okay. Line two. Okay.
Oh, hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
My question is actually about a topic which is perhaps tangentially related to the drug war. I'm actually curious if the speaker has heard anything about the Zapatistas since he's been in Mexico. I find it very difficult to find any information about them if they're still operating in the Lacandon jungle. And so I was just curious if media in Mexico has more information about them than the media I have access to here.
That's a great question. You know, the Zapatista rebels, you remember them, they had an uprising against the Mexican government in 1994 on the very same day the North American Free Trade Agreement was enacted. And they were an indigenous group, mainly of Mayan descent, who speak various languages in that part of southern Mexico, and they basically took up firearms, if you can call them that. Some of them were 22 rifles. Some of them were not even rifles at all. They were pieces of wood. Shortly thereafter, the government was able to contain that rebel movement. And now, years later, the question that our caller has is fantastic, because actually the Zapatistas are continuing to do their work. What they've done in specific parts of southern Mexico and Chiapas State is to create their own parallel governments. They have what they call in Spanish caracoles, which means a snail. And I asked them one time, we drove out to the jungles one time in 2008 to try to update the story on the Zapatistas. Where are they now with this process of trying to build their own government systems as well? And so they told us snail because it's a very slow pace of trying to fix the kind of long-standing, centuries-long problems of inequality, of poverty, children dying of curable diseases, these sorts of things. And so the Zapatistas do have their own governments called these caracoles. They have specific locations where the government will pass. You will see military vehicles passing through the area still. But in general, the Zapatistas are allowed to continue to have their governing bodies. They're based very much on the kind of communal style, indigenous style systems that they've had for centuries, where everybody sort of together decides who the members of the governing panel will be, how long they'll serve, and then they're removed, and then they install new people. So it's very much a democratic system on a very small scale. I don't think it would function in a big city like Mexico City. But the other really important thing that I found recently for our caller was that the Zapatistas are also talking with other indigenous groups throughout Mexico.
Interesting.
Yeah, they've been making trips, Brad, to places like northern Sonora State, which you know, this is the other extreme of Mexico in the north, near the United States, near the border with Arizona. And they'll go there and talk to indigenous people and see what kinds of systems are in place there. Do they need consulting? Are there documents that people need to create so that they can have their own governing systems? And in general, the government is allowing this to happen.
Yes. I think we have another caller on line four.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, this is Nancy in Pontiac, and I'm so glad to hear you on here. I became a big fan of Al Jazeera, and I watch it on Link TV, and I downloaded the app onto my phone. A couple questions. I wondered if you could give some perspective on what the United States looks like from the rest of the world. I won't comment. I'm curious what you think, what you hear from others, and what you think are the differences and similarities between our religious fundamentalism and the religious fundamentalism that we're so afraid of in Islam. And then last question is, when do you think Al Jazeera will be more generally broadcast and available in the United States?
Well, thanks very much. We've got two very broad questions there. Go ahead, Frank.
Thank you. About religious fundamentalism, outside the United States, I think even in your neighboring countries here, Canada and Mexico, I think that there's a sense that people feel that that this is starting to affect politics, political life, the kinds of decision-making that affects the countries, things like creating a border wall. It feels that, from a Mexican perspective at least, that the decision to have a tighter security apparatus on the southern border, in part, it has to do with very conservative ways of thinking. And people can respect that. They know that this is a sovereign nation that needs to decide its own way forward. But they also think that building these kinds of walls, these barriers, even militarizing the border, which I think is what is actually happening right now between the United States and Mexico, militarizing that border may not be the best way to manage the problem. Perhaps the problem needs to be looked at in more in terms of, and we're speaking here of the issue of immigration, illegal immigrants coming from Mexico. We know that right now the number of immigrants who are coming is actually at a historic low. Partly, in great part, I would say, because of the job market here in the United States. They know there are a few jobs. They're not coming. So, but there's going to be a flow when the job market picks up again. And there are people in Mexico who say, well, why don't we, rather than being so fundamentalist about things, why don't we think about it in terms of labor flow? So I think that in general, there's a sense that outside of the borders, that the United States is a fairly conservative country, actually. Mm-hmm. And when I come back to the United States myself, it's always a pleasure to be here. I love this country. I do feel that it's become more conservative in the years that I've been away, 15 years now, Brandt and our caller, Nancy. Mm-hmm. And I see the country trying to deal with the issues that it must deal with, the economy, these sorts of things. And it's very clear to me that there's a more conservative way of thinking about things. And so I think that, neighboring countries must deal with that. Fundamentalism in Islam, that's not my specialty area, really. Mm-hmm. But I do know that Islamic people are just like any other religion. There's a wide range of people. There are some who are very, very conservative. And there are others who are not. Al Jazeera in Arabic made its fame because they would put on debates, live debates, and you would see a woman dressed in the traditional Muslim dress, and then you would see a woman dressed kind of more Western style with a skirt on, and they would debate what is the role of the woman and of women in society. And these are the kinds of things that really lifted the Arabic network to high prominence. The Al Jazeera English network now hopefully will be broadcast more widely around the world. It is being carried in 500 million homes around the world now, so a lot of people can see it. In the United States, you can see it if you're in New York City. There is a former public television station carrying it in Los Angeles. And where you live, Nancy, I understand that if you'd like, you can go to the Al Jazeera, if you don't mind me saying so, you can go to the Al Jazeera website, and there's a place where you can basically suggest that you want Al Jazeera on your local cable system. And there's a little box you can see, and it's going to ask you for your name and your zip code, and you send it, and then that's automatically sent to your cable system. So you can, as a viewer out there, you can sort of vote for this network if you want it.
What's interesting, too, is it's not as adversarial a relationship with the U.S. that Al Jazeera has. In fact, there was a recent controversy where a director of Al Jazeera stepped down because of WikiLeaks, and it showed that the U.S. government was exerting pressure on Al Jazeera to remove some material. It may be awkward to ask this, but how did you feel about that situation?
This is a reference to the Director General of Al Jazeera, who stepped down just a few days ago this month. Again, you said it appeared to be related to a set of WikiLeaks documents that indicated that he was in constant meetings. Apparently, he was mentioned more than 200-300 times in the WikiLeaks documents in question here. The Al Jazeera director, and he was basically asked on a number of occasions to try to essentially clean up the images and not make them, try to put it more in terms of what the United States government might like to see coming out of Iraq. apparently, on at least one or two occasions, the Al Jazeera director general did concede and was able to back off a bit. That made a lot of people in the Middle East, when that information got out, it made a lot of people wonder, what about the independence of this network? Mm-hmm. And you could see a lot of chat comments around articles about this resignation, people wondering, well, did the network lose its independence? Mm-hmm. My particular sense is that so far it looks like the kind of editorial policy that we've been maintaining now for 5 years that the network's been on the air, the English language network, that has not changed. I'm not being told how to cover Mexico or Latin America. My colleagues, I'm told, in the Middle East are still free to report as they understand their job to be. These are people from Western nations, so they have our kinds of values on what journalism is. They're telling me that they're continuing to be able to do their job. The new director general is a member of the Emir's family, the Al Thani family. This is a family that has been governing the state of Qatar, the country of Qatar, where Al Jazeera is based. They've been ruling it, since the 1800s. And so a family member of that Emir is now the director general of Al Jazeera. And people are going to be watching very, very carefully. Does the editorial policy change? If it does, it's going to damage the credibility of the broadcast. What the director general, the former director general who resigned, says, he says, you, please, viewers, keep watching. And when you see it start to change, say something. And if you decide that it's not objective enough or balanced enough for you, then stop watching it.
It's interesting that Al Jazeera really has come much more into the mainstream as this shows, because quite often U.S. government officials, people may not know, are talking to the media companies about security risk or withholding information. So these conversations are going on all the time. What was unusual in this for our audience is that there was some conciliatory behavior by the director general at that particular point. But people should know these conversations are always occurring between government officials and the large media.
I don't suppose it will surprise you, but I understand that this happens even with National Public Radio. It happens with CNN, the BBC. These are media organizations that can affect the outcome of armed conflicts, and can the kind of reporting we do could sometimes result in violent protests, that sort of thing. And so, you know, you do have to take this very carefully and be, you know, very clear about the kinds of impacts. So it's not unusual that this kind of thing is happening. Hopefully the network will continue to broadcast with the kind of independence that it has had.
Well, I want to thank Frank Contreras for being with us today. We're going to continue the show for a while. If you have any questions you'd like to ask, please call 333-9455 or outside area, the area code, please call 800-222-9455. One quick question before we come to a break soon is, why hasn't the violence spilled across the border from Mexico in the drug war? I think that everyone wonders why it hasn't happened and if you think it will happen.
In large part, it has not happened. I would say mostly because the United States government is on top of it. They're watching very, very carefully what is happening. Now, there's a lot of intelligence taking place inside Mexico. We're told at this moment in history we have more United States intelligence agents operating in Mexico than ever before, and it's largely because of the drug-related violence and the proximity on the border. Some of the violence has spilled in. We have seen some arrests. There have been reports that indicate that drug trafficking organizations from Mexico are operating in various places across the United States in the drug trafficking at the local level. But in general, the violence so far has been contained, and I think it's partly because it's become a top priority between the two countries.
Okay. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back in less than a minute. Thanks.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of Public Engagement, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give is on the web at ccfd.illinois.edu.
Welcome back. This is Brant Houston from the College of Media. I'm sitting in for David Inge today, and with our guest Frank Contreras, who is a journalist for the Al Jazeera Network reporting in Mexico and Latin America. If you're interested in calling in, the phone number is 333-9455 or outside the area 800-222-9455. Well, Frank, we've been talking a lot about Mexico, but in fact, you are traveling around Latin America quite a bit. I think recently we're in Guatemala. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was in Guatemala to cover the first round of presidential elections there. It's a country that has been dealing with a lot of criminal violence itself. A lot of the drug trafficking organizations operating in Mexico have now moved into Guatemala. That's largely, Brandt, you can imagine, because of the fact that Guatemala is part of the land bridge between South America and North America. And so it's a place where landing strips are being put in place, clandestine landing strips used to bring in drugs from South America, cocaine specifically. And they're landing in the middle of the jungles in these Mayan ruin areas. And then the drugs are being transported over land, sometimes into Mexico. So it's an issue that the current Guatemalan government is struggling with. Guatemalans, as you know, had their own almost a sort of civil war for many decades. The government fighting leftist rebels, a very brutal, brutal situation there. People remember the violence, and they remember the presence of military officials. And in some cases, that was not a good memory. It was a memory of torture, of bloodshed. So now, when we get ready for the second and final round of presidential elections taking place on November 6th, it looks like one of the front runners is actually a military man himself. And people are wondering, how is it that Guatemalans might want to go back to that? You have to know that the man in question was actually in charge of signing the peace accords in 1996. He was involved directly with that process. And so so there's a sense that he might be the kind of person that the country needs at this stage. There's going to be final stage, two finalists facing off against each other on November 6th, as I said, a military man and a businessman. We're going to see who will be the next president of Guatemala.
Are you seeing an increasing U.S. presence there in terms of intelligence agents, military, as the drug war moves down to Guatemala? Have you noticed any of that? You're well aware of it in Mexico, of course.
In Mexico, certainly. And in Guatemala, an increasing number of U.S. agents are there. There's a strong U.S. embassy presence in Guatemala, and there has been for a very long time, since the 1950s and before. We know that intelligence gathering is taking place. The Mexican, the U.S. government and Guatemalan governments are working, along with the Mexican government, I should say, to try to gain intelligence, locate the trafficking organizations and try to make strategies so that they can contain them at the very least. A lot of what's happening right now appears to be violence taking place in the capital itself. A lot of people there told me stories about being held up at gunpoint, at traffic lights, things like that. One young woman said that she'd just gotten married, Brent, and she was driving her car and she was feeling pretty good that day. It was a sunny day in Guatemala City. Then a police officer came up to her, and she got very nervous, and she realized the police officer was taking out his gun, and he was going to rob her while she's sitting in her car at the traffic light. So in a moment of panic and sort of insight, she decided to slip off her wedding ring and swallow it.
An amazing story.
She didn't want that police officer to take the ring from her. So these are the kinds of things that people are dealing with in Guatemala.
So if you stand back from all your reporting right now, the drug war has been going on for decades. Do you talk to people who have any ideas about how to resolve this? It moved from Colombia, it's in Mexico, it's now moving to Guatemala. What do the policymakers, what do the people on the ground say about what can be done?
Well, people are starting to look seriously at the possibility of legalizing some drugs, marijuana. They point to recent FBI statistics that indicate that the vast majority of arrests that took place last year in the United States were drug-related arrests, and then the largest proportion of those were people who had marijuana on themselves, so on their person. And so there's a sense that if that particular drug could be legalized, perhaps that could take away some of the criminal element. In Mexico, it seems to me that there's always this argument that it's marijuana that's causing a lot of the problem, but my feeling really is it has to do more with the high profit drugs like cocaine. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the demand for that illegal drug is still very high, in some places growing, And so it remains a very profitable business. There's a sense that no matter what we do, there's going to be this illegal demand. So on the table, again, is this idea of the possibility of legalizing it. It doesn't seem to have any kind of political footing, not in our country, in the United States, or in Mexico, or in the rest of Latin America. So that's going to be a tough sell. On the ground, regular folks and political analysts I talk to and just people living in the country, they're thinking that maybe we ought to get back to what we had before, which was a government that sort of seemed to have negotiated something with these illegal organizations and allow them to work, allow them to consolidate and form these large organizations rather than having splintered smaller groups, and basically get back to a place at least where there's peace, at least where we're not seen, but decapitated bodies and things of that sort.
Bridges and, yeah.
It's been quite horrid, you know, and you don't think of that sort of thing happening in our hemisphere. Mm-hmm. So people are talking about that.
Well, it looks like we have a call from Champaign County. I'm going to go to that one right now.
Hi. Specifically on Guatemala, and you're talking about the runoff. My understanding, and I guess it was alternative reporting, that said that you know, people were disqualified in advance. I mean, the other elements that would have had possible a chance to go forward were disqualified by an electoral system. This is reminiscent of Haiti, where the disqualification of 7 or 8 parties isn't even commented on here. I also think that you should mention something and dismiss it if you would, but I've heard Mexicans talk about the militarization of the drug war, the Merida Accords, as being wrong in themselves in that they're counterproductive, but also as a cover for getting more military aid into Mexico for the usual suppression of civil society and movements around Mexico, not just the
guerrilla. What do you think about that, Frank?
On that last point, the presence of military to repress. Remember, Mexico actually, Brent, has one of the highest numbers of armed groups, rebel groups, anywhere in Latin America. There are a good number of people who are not happy with the situation and are willing still to take up arms against the Mexican government, specifically in the south. There's a place in the state of Guerrero where there are a number of armed organizations there who are angry with the government, angry with the kind of poverty that indigenous people there have been dwelling in for centuries. And they are willing to take up arms. They believe that this increased military presence is precisely for that reason, that whatever happens with the drug trafficking, the outcome with the fight against drug trafficking organizations, that in the end, this military apparatus will be in place. This high-level intelligence system for gathering intelligence will remain in place. And new laws have been passed, by the way, that allow the Mexican government to monitor our emails, telephone calls, and these sorts of things.
Sounds like what happened with Homeland Security in the U.S.
Very similar. In fact, I think it was modeled a lot on that, and it happened right around the same time. So it was a hemispheric security policy change that took place. And so there are people like our caller who are concerned about this inside Mexico, and they say that it's one of the things that needs to be watched because civil liberties could be the cost here, and there might be protest movements that are legitimate protest movements that might not be allowed to continue.
Looks like we have another call here. Let me go to this call. Thanks. Okay.
Okay, are you there?
Yes. Thanks for calling.
What's the situation concerning Fort Hood and our wonderfully famous School of the Americas in training the multiple groups of people in and out of the law in regard to arms supply? Most of the arms in Mexico, I think, are American. Trafficking of drugs and other items of interest, call it, by the military on American, Mexican, and other South American sites.
And your question is?
Question is, can you comment on any of it?
Okay.
Yes. This very morning, for example, Brent and our caller there, thank you for asking that. I was told by a source that I have, who I was speaking on the phone this morning, that this very day there are U.S. military officials in a Mexican military base giving training at this very moment that we're speaking right now. And they're showing soldiers in Mexico how to dismantle bombs. This speaks to a concern that we've seen rising because car bombs have been used now in this war against drug trafficking organizations. And so there are an increasing number of U.S. military officials operating in Mexico, giving training at these military bases in a very kind of quiet way. They know, the United States government, the Pentagon, and the president know that Mexico is very sensitive when it comes to sovereignty issues and this idea that U.S. troops should be on the ground. And so they're very, very careful on how to offer this kind of training and then actually conduct the kind of training. So it's not just happening at this so-called School of the Americas. This does happen, by the way. We still see a great number of military officers coming to the United States and soldiers themselves to learn how to fight counterinsurgency, for example. They're worried about counterinsurgency. We talked about rebel organizations in Mexico. And so these things are taking place. Both governments are very quiet about it, very sensitive, but it's happening right now. And I was just on the phone a few minutes ago with somebody who was telling me this very thing.
Well, we're here with Frank Contreras. This is Brand Houston from the College of Media, sitting in for David Inge today. If you're interested in calling in, the number is 333-9455, and outside the area it's 800-222-9455. What stories are you going to be covering, Frank, that are coming up? And you've got presidential elections. What other stories, let's say more enterprising, not as event-driven, what are you looking at covering in the coming year that you think are important issues?
Personally, I'm interested in trying to find out if we can get interviews having to do with the presence of foreign intelligence agents in Mexico to try to find out what is actually happening with that. We're hearing, and there's a place right on the main boulevard, which is kind of Mexico's equivalent to Wall Street and Washington, D.C., all wrapped into one. There's a building there, and everybody knows which building that is, and it's said that the building is filled with U.S. agents. Operating from the CIA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, the FBI, and a number of other organizations, alcohol, tobacco, firearms. And so we're interested in seeing if there's a way to talk about this, if this might be something that we might be able to address on the air. Another issue is you hear quite constantly now, Brent, that a lot of the drug crimes perpetrated, some of the most horrid ones, are perpetrated by a group calling itself the Zetas. Now, these were actually elite military forces in the Mexican army who were trained sometimes at the School of the Americas in the United States. Then they broke away from the government and joined up the trafficking organizations. Now they have their own cartel, and they're very powerful, heavily armed. We constantly hear that they're the ones perpetrating the crimes. And so I'm very interested in seeing, is there ever going to be a possibility of hearing their side of this story? And trying to find out what do they think when they hear the governments of both countries, the United States and Mexico, saying that it's the Zetas. It would be interesting to hear from that perspective, I think. So those are some of the things. And certainly the presidential election will be very important. There was a leftist candidate, as you will remember, who came in a very close second in 2006. He lost by 0.56% of the vote. His name is Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He has remained on the campaign trail. He is now broadcasting radio messages across the country saying, "I am not against business." That was the perspective. And so Al Jazeera and myself, we've sought out an interview with this candidate to see what does he say about this? What is he offering the country? Is he going to be protagonist against Mexico, against the United States, or is he going to be an ally? These are the kinds of things we're looking at.
I was curious, in terms of Al Jazeera and its coverage within the U.S., and particularly you're in Mexico, Latin America reporting, what kinds of reporting could go on that would explain to the audience in the Midwest why what's happening in Mexico matters. There's so much involvement. A lot of people feel that it's undercovered. We've a significant community here of Mexicans that have moved here, immigrants that are opening businesses and doing a lot here. There are a lot of stories. How can we do better as journalists in the U.S. at explaining why Mexico and Latin America matters in addition to the more controversial issues of immigration or the war on drugs? There's more a fabric of life kind of story going on.
Really, there really is. There are so many families that are connected with the two countries because of the two countries. There is so much economic activity that takes place. Mexico remains a major trading partner for the United States and for Canada, right? So there are so many different areas that we can begin to cover. I think that that it's a mistake to focus on immigration or the drug trafficking problem. There are so many other aspects, social life. I wonder about things like, for example, education policy. Here at the university, I was speaking with a group of students last night who are very concerned about something called the DREAM Act. You've heard of that. It's the idea of
yes.
Right, education for the children of undocumented immigrants. So these are some of the issues that I think media should explore more deeply to find out what are the two sides, what are the different sides on this debate, what is it really about, and is it in the best interests of both countries to educate these young people, or who pays the bill for that, and ask these kind of really hard questions, you know? So I think that there have got to be a lot of issues, I think. I imagine there are people living right now in your community in a clandestine fashion because they're worried about immigration and customs control, known as ICE, right? If you get arrested by the United States, in the United States now, you automatically will be held and then they'll check your background to see if you have your immigration papers in order. If you don't, then you're handed over to Immigration and Customs Control. So there are a tremendous number of Latin Americans in your community right now who are here in Urbana, in Champaign-Urbana, and throughout Illinois, who are living in this kind of secret way amongst us, you know? And so can we go to them and find out what is that like? What is that like to live in this situation? What does that make you think of the idea of liberty and justice for all?
Well, it looks like we have another caller. Let me go ahead and go to this caller from Champaign, I believe. Yes.
Hi. I was surprised to hear you talk about wanting to hear the Zetas' point of view, given that they've been responsible for numerous murders, torture, and so on. In all over Mexico and in the United States, and yet you seem to be almost supporting them. I'm not really interested in hearing about murderers. I'm interested in stopping them. And I would think that the people who suffer from them are more interested in stopping them than in your supporting them. It seems bizarre that's what you see your role as a journalist to do, to support this sort of violent behavior.
Sure. I imagine it sounds very strange to you. Please remember that I've been covering the drug trafficking war now on Al Jazeera for 5 years solidly, and we cover every aspect of what the Mexican government and what citizens are saying about this. We're on the air frequently about it. 2-3 times a week, wherever the hot spots are, Al Jazeera is there. We're broadcasting more than any other English language broadcaster, even more than the BBC and National Public Radio now from Mexico. There are two teams of correspondents constantly moving.
Well, I wanted to bring this up too, Frank. I heard you wanting to be informative about it as opposed to supportive of them. I think sometimes people do confuse the reporting as being supportive. I think you're talking about understanding more than supportive.
It's about interviewing them and about trying to find out
what's motivating them.
Yeah,
to this
sort of thing. I by no means support illegal drug trafficking and the violence that's perpetrated. It's some of the worst problems that's right now that's affecting Mexico. And if it starts to spill in the United States, you know, please, let's not have that happen. So certainly, please do not think that I support this in no way. But as a journalist, we're supposed to get out there and get the information out to you. to find out what motivates people, as you say. And
well, in your reporting with the Zetas, what would slow them down? What would cause them to cease this violent activity? In the reporting you've been able to do, what's the answer?
I'm not sure, but you know what? Frankly, what interests me in this is that both governments sort of seem to have a narrative taking place right now that seems to blame anything that occurs on this group. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like blame it on Zorro or something. And so as a journalist, it makes me want to go under that and try to find out, well, who is really behind this. Is it another drug trafficking organization? The Mexican government, unfortunately, has been accused of favoring one trafficking organization and attacking the others.
Talk about that a little bit. I think part of the difficulty in reporting then is, like all governments, there is spin, there is a point of view coming across. How much of the spin and misinformation do you find comes out of the Mexican government?
I would say it's really hard to gauge because unless you're omnipresent and you can be in all of these places simultaneously, that's the only way you can know. Even people who live in the communities that are directly affected by the bloodshed don't know for certain because they'll hear it's the Zetas and then they run for cover. And in the end, nobody knows for sure what's really happening. And so to try to get beyond the fear, I think it's important to find out. And so, as I said, the Mexican government has been accused of favoring one cartel, the Sinaloa drug trafficking organization run by Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, and attacking other organizations, making them weak so that this other powerful organization can rise. This is the accusation. I'm not certain if it's true, but I think it behooves us to try to find out what's actually happening.
Well, I just want to stop for a moment and let people know we're talking with Frank Contreras, who is a reporter for Al Jazeera, working in Latin America, particularly in Mexico. Very difficult circumstances there. If you did have a call and wanted to get a question in, the number is 333-9455, and outside the area, 800-222-9455. But I had a question right away, which is, how do you keep track of all these groups? Are you keeping a database? Are you doing what's known as social network analysis, connecting the dots? It seems like it's a very confusing situation to figure out who is doing what. And especially, as you said, many of these larger groups have fractured into smaller groups during the increased war on drugs in Mexico. How do you keep track of this?
It's a very difficult prospect to try to keep track of these groups. There's at least seven powerful groups, but there are another seven smaller groups, and they're constantly morphing. What we're told by intelligence agents in the United States and in Mexico is that on occasion they'll create temporary allies so that large shipments of drugs can move over one particular part of the U.S.-Mexico border. That alliance will work until it needs to, and then they break apart again and become enemies again. This is about money. This is not a fight over political ideology. This is not a fight about what the government ought to be like.
How much money are we talking about these days?
It's hard to calculate, but they're talking about $50 billion a year. I don't know how you calculate the numbers because, again, it's an illegal market, but certainly in the billions and billions of dollars, and a lot of people are getting very, very wealthy from this. And so that seems to explain why would apparent enemies join forces temporarily and then break apart. So this is constantly happening. Also, one other very important thing that we're told about the violence itself is that in some instances you'll have four trafficking organizations in one city. Acapulco, for example, this is happening right now in Acapulco, a resort town, as you know. The Sinaloa cartel seems to have now captured control. The other three organizations are now vying for the money. They're losing money because the Sinaloa cartel is so powerful. And so they've resorted to other kinds of crimes, extortions. They're kidnapping people. And lately, they've been demanding that teachers hand over 50% of their salaries, their monthly salaries, to these other three organizations. So while the Sinaloa cartel is moving the drugs and making the high profits there, these other organizations want to stay in the money.
Well, what's the involvement of the financial systems, the financial world in all this? If you have $50 billion, you've really got to move it around. I think it would be a little too bulky in pure cash.
Can you imagine? Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you hearing about that? Where's the money getting funneled to? Where is it getting hidden away and so forth? Is it being invested in regular businesses? Is it being stored away in banks in sort of outlaw countries. Where's that money going?
We're starting to see that it's a lot of all of that that you just mentioned. Experts are telling Al Jazeera that essentially we're seeing a huge amount of that money, a huge amount of the money flowing into the legitimate economy. And what you see in Mexico City, for example, in the neighborhood where I live, there are at least 8 different high-rise projects taking place as we speak. They're building high-rise condominiums in an economy that's stagnant in a time of recession. We're always told by economists that whenever you have construction of that scale, it means it's a starter to the economy. It's a strong push. That's not the case. So the question is, where's the money coming from? It could be drug-related money. We're not certain. There's no way to track it at this stage. There have been households in wealthy parts of the country where large amounts of physical cash have been discovered, huge cubes of, you know, a meter and a half wide, which is what, a little over a yard, 2 yards, of a cube of solid bills, U.S. bills, being held in one of these mansions. And so I think it's a lot of what you're saying, and tracking the money has been one of the hardest parts of this.
Well, and one last question. We're getting near the end, so we'll have to be brief. But, of course, it's close to my heart. I teach investigative reporting and have practiced it for years at the University of Illinois. Has Al Jazeera considered having a special investigative team looking into some of these issues in Mexico, and not only the drug traffic but the financial traffic?
Yes, Al Jazeera does have a special investigative documentary team. You can check it online, their work. It's a program called Fault Lines, and they look at – it actually began as coverage of the United States, of what's happening inside the United States politically and socially, Fault Lines. And now they're covering the rest of the world. Yeah, so
So we can watch for more deep reporting on this.
Right, and that'll be documentary productions of the kind that really have shown the power of the Al Jazeera network to be able to report these stories in very high quality.
Well, we'll be wanting to watch that. I want to thank our guest, Frank Contreras, for being with us today. He is a reporter, experienced reporter for Al Jazeera, the network in coverage of Mexico and Latin America, started his career out here in the Midwest, and hopefully will be keeping informing us of what is so important and what's happening in Mexico and Latin America and how it affects us. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be here. Way to track it at this stage. There have been households in wealthy parts of the country where large amounts of physical cash have been discovered, huge cubes of, you know, a meter and a half wide, which is what, a little over a yard, 2 yards, of a cube of solid bills, U.S. bills, being held in one of these mansions. And so I think it's a lot of what you're saying, and tracking the money has been one of the hardest parts of this.
Well, and one last question. We're getting near the end, so we'll have to be brief. But, of course, it's close to my heart. I teach investigative reporting and have practiced it for years at the University of Illinois. Has Al Jazeera considered having a special investigative team looking into some of these issues in Mexico, and not only the drug traffic but the financial traffic?
Yes, Al Jazeera does have a special investigative documentary team. You can check it online, their work. It's a program called Fault Lines, and they look at – it actually began as coverage of the United States, of what's happening inside the United States politically and socially, Fault Lines. And now they're covering the rest of the world. Yeah, so
So we can watch for more deep reporting on this.
Right, that'll be documentary productions of the kind that really have shown the power of the Al Jazeera network to be able to report these stories in very high quality.
Well, we'll be wanting to watch that. I want to thank our guest, Frank Contreras, for being with us today. He is a reporter, experienced reporter for Al Jazeera, the network in coverage of Mexico and Latin America, started his career out here in the Midwest, and hopefully will be keeping informing us of what is so important and what's happening in Mexico and Latin America and how it affects us. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be here.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square this Saturday morning at 7, featuring Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in downtown Urbana. Information online at urbanaillinois.us/market.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at mid-session, U.S. grain futures are higher in what is being termed a short covering bounce as European financial markets are steadying amid relief over the region's debt crisis. The recovery is coming as European stocks and the euro rose following approval by Germany's parliament of new powers for the Eurozone's rescue fund. And that's a move that is expected to provide some relief from concerns for the region's debt crisis. Wheat prices are higher. They're being led by Minneapolis spring wheat futures, which are up 4%. The weaker dollar also helping the market at mid-session. Soybeans coming off a 10-month low, while corn has some modest gains heading into the second half of today's trade. And